The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and testimony. And it's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you'd like a free copy of the magazine, head to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Today we're bringing you something a bit different. It's my interview with Nadim Adnan Laperouse, the father of Natasha, who died in 2016 after suffering a severe allergic reaction to an unlabeled pret-a-manger sandwich. The story of the 15-year-old's death travelled the world over, but what wasn't reported was the powerful spiritual experience Nadim had on the day of her death. This led him to faith. I sat down with Nadim to hear the whole story. Listen in. Nadim, tell me about your attitude to faith before you became a Christian. Had you had any kind of interaction with Christianity at all?
Yeah, I think, so I'm 55 years old now, and it's a recent thing to have any kind of connection to faith. All probably my previous life, if I call it, if you like, most of my life, I really had no... certainly no desire to know God, or didn't really think of God at all, actually. And in fact, people who I met that were sort of that way inclined, and I used that language because it's kind of how I talk about it back then, I thought were really somewhat annoying and really bugged me, and just wanted to move away from them, actually. An example would be I think that I remember clearly, actually, way back. So when I'd be sort of at university in Manchester, back in the 80s, there was a girl I really liked a lot. And, you know, I think was sort of, you know, trying to be her boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, that sort of situation. Someone I didn't know, really. But her friend, a good friend of hers, who came from her own town somewhere in the southwest, was definitely a Christian, someone in Christian youth. And was found really annoying, actually. She was always around, if you like, and kind of just far too happy, too joyful, you know. I can look back at it now and almost laugh about it, because I can see it, you know, for what it was, and frame it in a way, you know, annoyingly happy, joyful. You know, when you're a student, it's all about other stuff. It's certainly not to be, you know, to find yourself in year one all happy and joyful. That's really annoying, actually, you know, if that's how I'd look at it now. And that was the first instance. And I think before that I'd had a girlfriend, actually, very briefly, wouldn't even call a proper girlfriend, at when I was doing secondary school, my A-levels, who was something I'd never heard of before, called a Christian Scientist, which I thought was completely balmy. I didn't really understand it, and didn't want to understand it, actually, at that age, anyway, for me. And her mother was a Christian Scientist, and kind of, therefore, her daughter was. That's how it sort of came across to me. And you know, that didn't last long, really. It was all kind of wonky for me and weird. And that's how I would kind of broadly describe my interaction, or lack of interaction, or thought of God. Everything I was doing, it was in my own strength. Really, that's what I'd say. It was me, myself, and I, and up to me to make things happen, always. And if I didn't put the hard work in, or whatever was needed, nothing would happen. You know, so I was sort of this idea of being in control of one's own destiny. Mm-hmm. That's how I'd describe broadly my thinking.
Would you know. Go as far to say that you were an atheist?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Atheist seems like a really strong word in a way, because it's such a weird word, actually. When you see it written down, it's like, oh, is that even English?
Yeah,
actually.
You usually get the I and the E the wrong way around.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's hard one to spell.
Yeah. Have to tell if someone's a real atheist, check their spelling of it. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wouldn't actually say I wasn't someone who'd proclaim, go on the streets, an anti-God, anti-Christ type of thing, you know, whatever that might really mean anyway. But it's someone who had, definitely someone who had no, I would say, had no conscious active space for God or desire for or will, and would go really just zone completely out if anyone really was talking about it. And but I wouldn't really say per se I would actively, you know, go out with vehement and fire and spit saying anything that, you know, it's not true. I never really found myself in those situations, or if you like, boxed into a situation where I'd have to perhaps fight back like that. But actually, God was really not at all in my life, and I had no desire for any God. And as far as I'm concerned, was there a God? No, not really.
Mm. Tell me about your daughter, Natasha. What was she like, and what was your relationship with her like?
Well, as a father, I mean, a lovely girl. I mean, in many ways, a lot of the teenage bit of angst, of course, you know, goes without saying. Who's going to bypass that thoroughly?
Yeah.
But she was really wonderful. She was really quite a gutsy girl. I mean, that she was really up for all sorts of things, whether it was flying planes or jumping, you know, skydiving.
Wow.
Age 15. All number of things, really. I mean, to a point where you go, wow, as a dad, as me being kind of a bit more sort of, I would say, a go-getting type of person, that's, you know, really in my work, business life, certainly in the past, that's certainly what I would want from a daughter. You know, if I had,
yes,
to say, what kind of character would you like? Well, someone who's go-getting, gutsy, not afraid, not someone who's sort of prissy, and sort of just, you know, bashful and shy, and just going to be someone that I felt was going to really make a mark for herself somewhere along the line in some way. That's how I describe her, yeah.
I understand that in the months prior to her death, she was exploring faith and along the road to becoming baptised. Is that right?
Well, yes. Yeah, so her best friend, Bethany, who's 14 at the time Natasha died, her father, Bethany's father, is a pastor. I've now found out, only recently, that he's actually somebody who's funded by stewardship.org.uk, and he's like a kind of missionary sort of role, but not in foreign countries, you know, behind enemy lines type of thing, more like speaking at churches to all sorts of people all week long, all around the country. But he was quite obviously very connected to God. Not that I knew him at all, but Bethany and Natasha were best friends, and Bethany used to sing, she's a bit older now, used to sing in a youth church choir in Wimbledon, in a church called Everyday Church. And Natasha, for probably a year prior to her dying, was going to the youth thing, sort of bit on a Friday night. And what happened was, sort of through that interaction, I sort of got, I suppose I could look back, closer to the whole idea of God, really, and with Bethany as a best friend. And actually, 2 weeks before she died, Natasha told Bethany that she wanted to get baptized. She didn't tell me this myself. We know this because Bethany actually told us, actually, this is what happened, just prior. We know that Natasha, and Tanya knows it as well, more than I did at the time, that Natasha was sort of, if I put it right, veering towards God, veering that way, unlike the rest of us, really, meaning myself. I was probably the most extreme, the other end. Tanya, as a mother, perhaps as a woman with more sensitivities, I don't know, inherently so, you know, more around home rather than me not around home, had picked up on Natasha's sort of sentiments towards it. And Tanya started to go to Everyday Church as well, just to find out what on earth is this all about, actually. You know, what's our child interested in, and so on.
So did she ever get baptised, or was that just in her plans?
No, she never did get baptised. She died before that. But when I got baptised, I actually, at Everyday Church, in the swimming pool, I call it, below the stage, you know, that, if you like. That's how I sort of look at it, in a way. I had a T-shirt on with her picture printed on her name, so we sort of went under the water together, kind of symbolically, if you like,
yes,
you know. You know,
that's
yes,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow. When you discovered that Natasha was going to church more, this is before you became a Christian.
Yes.
What was your reaction?
I was fine with her going to, I call it, youth group, because to me it really just felt like a youth club of sorts, and great, you know, she's got going out somewhere, it's this kind of safe place with a friend and so on, and it didn't bother me at all. And in fact, to be honest, I didn't really engage with it at all, actually, is the truth. That was her on a Friday night or Friday evening, and my Friday evening or night was meeting some, you know, friends and going out, for a drink. Not that I ever drank much at all, but just, you know, social, if you like. So we sort of all went our separate ways. So I never really paid, honestly, any real attention to it or noticed it, actually.
Yeah. But it didn't bother you?
No, it didn't bother me at all, no.
Okay. Tell me about, if you can, in as much detail as you can, about the day on the plane. So were you and Natasha going somewhere specifically together? Or were you all together as a family?
No, so that it was unusual in that we'd never... So myself, Natasha, and Bethany, her best friend, who's 14 at the time, the three of us going to south of France, to Nice. Mm. Now, we'd never done... Actually split the family up. But by that means, you know, myself, as a family, the four of us, myself, Tanya, my wife, and two children, we'd always gone anywhere together and everywhere, abroad as well. But this time round, Natasha really wanted to show Bethany, her best friend, the kind of holidays that Natasha, she'd had in the years gone by in the south of France, and how great it was, etc. And Bethany hadn't actually, I don't think she'd ever left the UK at that time. And then our son Alex, who's 2 years younger, he had a friend coming over to stay, you know, from France, oddly. So the whole thing was like a kind of mix and match. So just the three of us, myself, Natasha and Bethany, on a plane, basically going out of Heathrow to Nice, and then staying in our, what was at the time my parents' apartment in Nice, with like a holiday home, if in effect, and just the three of us. Yeah, so it was a kind of regular thing. I used to fly pretty much every 2 weeks somewhere around the world for work. So airports for me was kind of just, you know, very quite mundane and quite standard stuff, really. Yes, because it was an early flight, like the first flight out at something like 7 a.m. type of thing. We didn't eat any breakfast before leaving the house. And Tanya drove the three of us, drove us to Heathrow and dropped us off. And Natasha, and the girls were so excited because it's like going away together, just the two of them, not with the whole class. And they're just really buzzing, you know, and you know, wearing whatever they wanted to wear, you know, the sloppy kind of like onesie pajama, you know, that sort of thing, you know, that, you know, how girls are, I would say, or can be, maybe. And listening to each other's music, you know, that thing where they have one earpiece each, you know, from one sort of digital device. And they just said quickly, we said quickly goodbye to Tanya, you know, just the drop off, and then we went into the terminal Heathrow, and you know, went through, and then they were really hungry. The two girls were quite hungry because it was kind of early start, and the rumble on the tummy. Mm. Yeah, I know what that's like. I think we all know when you get up earlier than normal, the tummy rumbles. You know, says calls out for something. and we grabbed some food at a Pret-a-Manger. I've been there many times in Terminal 5 on my work travels. And Natasha was severely allergic to milk, eggs, sesame seeds, had been all her life. But we've, as a family, everybody knew that. And we were very careful about how we negotiated around that, especially Natasha as well. Had inappropriate medicines, if you like, which is antihistamine. A couple of adrenaline injections, which is what you'd have if you had a snake bite or something, or an allergic reaction.
And had all of those with you?
Always, yeah. Mm. It's like, military issue, I'd call it. You don't go anywhere without it. And that was just part of life. It was quite fine. Nothing to be overly concerned about. Just it's the way we worked and operated. We went in and looked at the sandwiches that were wrapped up on the shelf in this kind of fridge cabinet, and Natasha picked one out and looked at it. There's this label on it saying what was in it. And I looked at it. It was fine. And when Natasha had, you know, like younger eyes than me, meaning really sharp on detail, visibly sharp. So you could look at something and see things in it that I couldn't even see, if you know what I mean, from her. And I said, yep, that's fine. Yeah, it's fine. So we bought it. And we sat down, you know, chomped through our food in about 10 minutes, basically, before we had to get on the plane, which was literally 100 yards away, the gate. And Natasha started to feel a bit unwell. Well, unwell really means what's called an itchy throat.
Mm.
And that's kind of an allergic person's speak, itchy throat, for, there's something maybe about this food that's giving me a little mild reaction. Mm. So she took something called Piriton, which is over-the-counter antihistamine. Mm. And if that such a situation was quite relatively routine, might happen once in a while, and the itchiness, as it was called, go away, you know, that's it. Thought nothing much of it, actually, any of us, because, well, the sandwich was clearly fine, you know, as far as we thought. But, you know, when the plane was in the air, it's a 1 hour, 50-minute flight, sort of roughly 2 hour flight. The plane was in the air, and, you know, half hour or more in, she was really not feeling great and sort of getting more itchy, if I call that, and then swallowing more Piriton, and then having... taking a fair amount of what you call asthma inhaler, if you blue inhaler, for example. And I thought I didn't think too much of it. You know, the three of us were sitting in a line, you know, as it were, in one row of seats, and I was on the end by the aisle. And then Natasha had got up, you know, sort of saying, "Oh, you know, not feeling that great," and went to the loo. I didn't think much of it. Maybe, you know, it was early morning. Maybe maybe it was even the time of the month, you know, for her, for example. I really wasn't sure.
Yeah.
But everything had been so routine, I didn't see any cause for, you know, alarm. I mean, we'd lived, remember, a life already for 15 years like this, and one didn't get alarmed, overly alarmed, you know, live like a kind of complete nightmare life. We were kind of felt quite in control of things, to be honest.
Yeah.
But when she came back, sometime later, probably about 8 minutes later, from the toilets in the plane, she sat down and said, "Daddy, I'm really not feeling well at all." And she lifted up her shirt, her top, like that, and I could see she was covered in huge red welts, raised like pattern on skin, like a giraffe's pattern, but raised up, and really bright red, like shocking, you know. Never seen that before in my life. On her, or indeed anyone else, actually. Oh my gosh, that is terrible. I'm not sure what's going on, but this is a severe allergic reaction to what? Wasn't sure, because, you know, so far everything
didn't think of the sandwich.
And she said, "Daddy, you know, you're really having trouble breathing, and can you give me give me the EpiPen, basically inject me with the EpiPen. Let's go to the toilet." So I called the steward just who was passing by in the cabin. I said, "We need to, you know, my daughter's having an allergic reaction. I need to give her an injection of an EpiPen." He said, "Okay, come to the toilet and, you know, go there." That's the toilet at the front of the plane, literally the one you walk past when you kind of get on the plane. And we quickly went in there, and she sat on the loo, and in a really very smaller toilet for two people, actually, two kind of adulty type size people. Closed the door. She wanted to close the door because it was, you know, girls and their privacy, and they're so embarrassed about things at that age. You know, they never want to be different.
It goes into her thigh, does it?
Yeah. Yeah. Sat down and pulled down her jogging pants, and I injected her with it into her thigh and counted to 10 and did all the things that I kind of know you had to do, and checked for a spot of blood as well. That would tell you the needle's pierced through, and therefore it's discharged its adrenaline. I thought, "Oh, thank God for that." I thought, you know, that's great. That was my thinking. Thank God for that. Great. Should all be fine now. And I'd never actually done that before, by the way. So it wasn't for me a routine thing in any way. But she was really having trouble breathing, you know, gasping for air, like a kind of fish that when you see a fish in a goldfish bowl and you wonder, why is it constantly at the top of the bowl, you know, what looks like, frankly, gasping, and we can't feel that pain of that fish in a way, and we look at it, you know, it was kind of like that. I just, daddy, I can't breathe, get the second one. I thought, oh my gosh, this is, you know, her serious tone and her sort of real exasperation, I don't know the word, you know, her whole sound was not
panicked,
good, panicked,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, panicked. I ran back to see, got the second one, gave the second injection. I was just now into a kind of mode of like, it's all going to be okay, isn't it? Okay. And talking to her, we've done the right thing, da 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 da. Now, none of us, either of us, had ever been through this situation before, I have to say. So I can look back with no idea what the outcome would be. But actually, the way we've always believed as a family, somehow come to learn through doctors or whoever, that if you've got an adrenaline pens, these are your lifesavers, basically. These are the bullets that are going to save your life, so to speak. So you really do have that belief because you've had drummed into us or absorbed that for years. But it was not the case at all. And things within minutes got much worse, much, much worse. And it went into an abyss, basically. Mm. Unbelievable. The drama, you know, she was passing out. You know, her face was really swelling. And I got out of the toilet into the jump seat next to the door where you walk in, where the air crew sit down at takeoff, and called quickly for the steward. I said, get an oxygen mask right away, now, get it now, you know. And he bought the bottle of oxygen, which is a portable one. I put the mask on the face, turned it up full blast. And at this point, I was thinking, gosh, I couldn't ever imagine she would actually die. It was unthinkable. It just, brain doesn't go there. I was now in process mode, basically, thinking back as a father, but also to my science background, really, like, okay, thinking we've got pure oxygen. I know the air is 80%, you know, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and, you know, and 20% oxygen. By giving her pure oxygen, I should offset the fact that the narrowing of her airways, you know, and I was kind of just balancing it out that way in my mind, you know, instantly like that, and thinking, okay, this should get us through, you know, somehow, but not thinking through to what. You know, it's in the moment, the then and the now. But nothing, it just wasn't working. She was, fell unconscious, completely, you know, lumped. This is in minutes, a matter of minutes. And the crew was just standing there, looking there. I said, for God's sake, I said, call for if there's a doctor on board, someone. And they made a call, and in a matter of minutes later, this young guy appeared through the curtain, you know, as it were. He looked like, could be my son, you know, really, compared to me, like half my age, if that, which in itself seemed like, oh gosh, like
that's not what you want, is it? When
oddly enough, it felt like that, but you know, he said, I'm a junior doctor, I've just qualified yesterday. He said, oh my gosh, okay, so I briefed him exactly what happened and what I'd done so far, and we lay now Natasha, who was unconscious, on her back on the floor of the plane in the galley, it's called, serving area, you know, if you like, where they have the food trolley things, and which is a really tight space actually, and he went through all the kind of things that he could think of, which was, well, started CPR, you know, and so on. And I was talking to Natasha all the time because I don't know how to do CPR. I have to say, I could guess it, but I wouldn't do it properly at all. But he, you know, was doing his CPR. He called for some help from one of the air stewards to hold her in a certain position. Now she's unconscious now, you know, and so on. And you know, the whole situation just went bad to worse. I just couldn't believe what was happening. I sort of went into a kind of like a no man's numbness, if you like, but still. I remember acting it through, you know, like talking to her constantly in a slightly raised voice above the level of the cockpit noise, you know, if not cockpit, the level of general background noise, the hum and stuff. It's quite noisy, actually, when you stop to listen in a plane, the level of noise. And she's having, she went to cardiac. Oh, saying, Tasha, I know you can do it. Come on, be strong. I know you win all your races at school, you know, for all her asthma, for example, that she'd had at school, when running a race at like the sports day thing, she would always win them, the running the race, because she would just go flat out to run it and suffer the consequences afterwards. And so I knew she had strength in her, and I knew she was gutsy, you know, and had what I'd call balls, you know, right, you know, then back then I can use those words and so on, and I knew she wasn't, you know, she's a fighter, was not a quitter or limpy or lame in what I would see as a father when I think about her. And so I was just calling her to fight on, you know, no response at all. She was unconscious, she was in multiple cardiac arrest now situation, but the plane kept flying on, and when it eventually did land, the paramedics came straight on board there, and So five of them, actually. These huge guys, really big, burly, like firemen in France. Actually, they're not kind of as dainty as British paramedics. Massive guys, big boots. And there was nowhere physically for them to be because in that space, it was, and it was like they were standing on her. They were actually standing on her arms. And I was like, stop, what are you doing? You know, I was like, and they, you know, they got to work trying to do what they're trying to do. But, it, yeah, none of it worked, basically. I mean, you know, what, you know, she died on the plane in I know that from my, from God telling me that, showing me
before
that.
It had landed.
No, it's on the tarmac.
On the tarmac.
Everybody had been, all the other passengers had been taken off the plane from the back of the plane. So they didn't see what was going on in the front, behind the curtain. And so we were on the tarmac. The plane had landed for about half an hour or more before she actually died, yeah. And she was taken to hospital, yeah.
Was Bethany with you at this point?
Yes. So Bethany, 14-year-old girl, you know, her best friend, Natasha, in a terrible state. And Bethany, certainly never been through this in her life. It wasn't something, you know. And I wasn't thinking about Bethany during the flight at that point. She was been sitting in her seat. And when the plane had landed, she'd come forward to the front seat, but still on the other side of the curtain. And she was praying nonstop, absolutely praying nonstop all the time.
That brings us to the end of part one of today's show. Coming up, Nadim describes the angels he saw hovering over Natasha's body just before she died.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome back to The Profile with me, Megan Cornwell. Today on the show, we're hearing from Nadim Ednan Leparus, whose daughter Natasha died from a severe allergic reaction to a pret-a-manger sandwich. Nadim, who was an atheist before his daughter died, experienced a profound spiritual event on the day of her passing that led him to faith. Listen in. You say that you saw angels hovering over her body. Can you tell me in as much detail as you can what you saw?
Yes, well, you can imagine. Well, I can imagine. The situation was really dire, and Natasha's heart had started. So the paramedics were doing lots of CPR, really vigorous, and they were like sweating. You know, it was quite warm on the tarmac as well, and the amount of physical exertion they were taking in turns, literally, to, you know, at it, if you like, and they were trying to force a tube down Natasha's throat to try and ventilate her, as they call it, get the air into her lungs, because her throat, not just her throat, really all other tubes going down had closed up, but they couldn't get a tube down her lungs, they just couldn't. But anyway, her eyes were open, unconscious, but her eyeballs were completely full of vomit, where she'd vomited up from being forcing. If you push someone's stomach or chest that much, you know, and you don't have control over it because you're not conscious, it's just going to throw everything up. So it literally like a washed over her face, and her eye sockets were full of the food she'd eaten, which was very red pesto. And so it looked, she looked, you could say, like the devil in a way. You know, if you saw it in a film and you opened her eyes,
really
all you saw
scary.
Was red.
Yeah.
But, and it was awful. And I at one point, I was thinking, oh gosh, her stomach acid, and we know how strong stomach acid is, it must be burning her eyeballs, her corneas. She's going to go blind, you know, that sort of thing. But anyway, so her heart beat, she's rigged up to a defibrillator, which was showing the signs of heartbeats, you know, as it were, and her heart came back. And this is after, like, you know, going into in and out of multiple cardiac arrests, basically, you know, and now I think back of it, I mean, the nightmare situation going on for 45 minutes, 1 hour. I mean, I don't know, you know, think about that in a hospital, that is just horrific in a hospital, let alone on the floor of a plane. And a heartbeat came back. So the paramedics in French, and I speak fluent French, kind of went, oh, look, this is good news, you know, so to speak, in terms of the heart piece. And yes, it's great. And we all high-fived each other like that with great sort of slapping hands, you know, quite vigorously because they're really strong guys, and as it were. And then the heart fainted, just went. And they went back to CPR, see, pushing, sweating. And it came back as just as a murmur. And they were, oh, but it's still weak, really weak. And then it went again, you know, like that. But what happened was, at that point, and there were some, we'd been some time on the ground, I was standing there, I was holding a bottle of saline solution, which was rigged up, hooked up, you know, all temporary kind of sort of thing, hooked up onto the curtain pole, etc. And I was standing over her body, like that, literally, actually, like right in front of my feet, and there's where you are, paramedics all in front, all around, basically, all on the ground level. And I was just in kind of disbelief at the whole situation. You know, I'd been talking to her nonstop now for an hour and a half, loudly, you know, talking. Tasha, you can make it. Come on, baby, you can do it. You can do it. So I had this sense of that I wanted her, if at all, through her sort of a conscious state, somehow to know that I was still with her and she wasn't alone. And it's just suddenly these five angels appeared. I mean, can you imagine, I'm not looking for this, you know, and I'm actually a very quite lucid person, actually. You can, you know, friends will say that, people who know me from business, I'm not someone who has kind of, you know, funny moments as such, or whatever you want to call it. These five angels just appeared, and I know they're angels because, well, they were basically people with wings. That's the first thing, and I've never seen that in my life before. And they just were from her head to her toe, hovering over her. All moving around different heights, not waving their arms and flapping like some kind of, like each one was a, neither of them was a cartoon in motion, if you like. They're all very succinct, very, I wouldn't say they were moving up and down across, but slowly, not in some frantic way, like it's like what was happening on the ground with physically. And they
was
were made
at a completely different pace to what was
completely
happening.
Different pace. Yeah. It was somewhere else, something else,
otherworldly.
Mm. And I recognize. I say they're angels. You know, I don't have a piece of paper given to me to say these are angels, but they were. I would call like human beings in effect, in long, with wings coming off their backs, off from the behind. You know, but more like butterfly wings, not like no feathers, for example. And moving around, and so taken aback because my whole vision was filled with that. Suddenly it wasn't like they were in front of your face, and if I said, could you just move aside and I could see your face again, the whole vista filled up with this yellow light, and they were made of yellow light as well, but stronger than the background light, but soft, very soft light, you know, not a one you'd squint at, actually. Really like the not even a filament of a light bulb, because that's much too bright. It's, I look around, I can't see anything like it when I look around. Soft.
Like that kind of dusk, like when the sun sets.
Yes, sort of more of a sunsetty, but even then that's too orangey. These were really core yellow at their heart, and not orange at their heart, if in terms of as a colour. I have an artistic background, so I know my colours, if you like, in that sense, to say that. But and I just, and I was so taken aback. I literally went, like that, what is that in my, and then dawned on me what that meant. Oh my gosh, why would I see that? That's because, you know, and it kind of, anything I'd ever heard of before, you know, randomly in my entire life raced forward to my mind, that must mean that, you know, and I just wouldn't accept that. Absolutely. And I lifted my hand and whooshed them away like that, is in, get out of here, you know, it's not her time. And they just all, just in a, all gone. And that's when Natasha died, because her heart with the faintness went, and the paramedics, who had been actively doing what they'd been doing for now quite some time, at least half an hour, were just like completely beaten and just, as they stood back, they couldn't physically stand back in the sense of walk away, but just stopped. And we're kind of just looking at each other, not looking at each other like that, because they're exhausted and shattered, and emotionally shattered. I know that. And that was the end, yeah.
You said that nobody else in the room could see the angels. Mm. Do you have any sense of why that was?
I mean, imagine I would say I'm a fool like any other fool. I'm a man like any other man, or I'm a human being like any other human. I'm nothing different about me, you know, in that way. I just surmised that, because nobody else mentioned anything, that said, well, did you see that? I mean, what was that about? Nobody said that to me, for example. And also nobody had the view that I had. No one was standing where I was standing. I was the only one there. Again, the physical space is so small that you can't all stand. It's not like being standing around. Look, all the other people are on the ground, on their knees, if you like. And Bethany, Natasha's best friend, was sitting around the corner, so she was out of line of sight of Natasha, actually. And you think the whole thing was so traumatic. The last thing you'd want, actually, is to see her to be physically watching what was going on, as it were, anyway. The other person who was there was the captain of the aeroplane. He was standing facing me from his cockpit, you know, looking out from the little door that the cockpit, which just literally is the size of you, the width of a man's shoulders, really. And he was just crying, looking down and crying at what he was seeing below, you know, at his feet. And then I know there was an air steward. He was crying. All the paramedics would look really beat, you know, and just despondent, if you like. And you know, there was no mention, you know, of what I had seen or anyone had seen in that way at that point, you know. So my sort of view, if you like, is that it was something meant, you know, given to by God for me to see, really, for a reason. You know, otherwise, I suppose you might say things like that flash up all the time. Well, I'm not aware of it, but maybe many are, but I'm not aware of it. But I know that. That's how I really feel it, very strongly, that it was given to me to see. And also, you know, probably to change the course of my life. I think had I not seen that, actually, I can literally call it a linchpin moment or point in time. Had I not seen what I saw, which I know is the truth, and I'm happy to die for it now. You know, someone could interrogate me now and say, I will kill you unless you say otherwise, you know. And I said, well, you're going to have to kill me then. That's the truth of it, because that's how I see it's the truth. And from that point, and I would call it a point, you know, it's probably got to be the lowest point in my life, definitely. In that sense, you know, everything's changed for me, really, in a way that I look at the world or the way. I mean, I'm not saying 100% changed myself in the sense that, you know, I still do a fair few things I used to do, but my mindset, you know, has changed. Natasha died on a Sunday morning. Basically, myself and Tanya brought her body back in the same plane. Basically, we got that to happen, and her coffin was below her feet, basically, in the plane, and that was Friday night. It took 5 days to get her to organise to bring her body back to the UK, and on the 2 days later, on the Sunday following, I was in that church for the first time in my life, basically. In everyday church, Wimbledon, and I've probably been but I've certainly probably only missed a handful of weekends total since then, and that's 3.5 years it's worth. So, you know, 150 plus visits, if you like, and in that time, I've learned quite a lot about the Bible, and in fact God and Jesus, actually, through actually the verbal teachings of certain aspects of the Bible from the preachers or people come to talk. And I found that it's really engaging, actually, because I think partly they preach really well, or, you know, that's one thing, and it's interesting. I find it interesting as well. And I remember, if ever, the once or twice I've been to what I call a straightforward Anglican church, like, you know, when a baptism, someone's baptism or wedding, frankly felt like falling asleep, partly because nothing's being said that's interesting. I mean, that was, of course, in, you know, what I call my former self, by the way, anyway. But here, this is slightly more everyday, so slightly, I'd call it more evangelical, if that's the word, the right label as such. And it is interesting, and the people look quite normal, as opposed to dressed up in something that makes me feel really different from them, and so on. So that, and through that, and then that me being interested by what they're saying, I've picked up other things and read things and found my sort of I call it a wonky teaching, if that's a word. You know, it's not like I studied it at school or in some kind of academic
formal way.
I've come to know more, but moreover, I think the big piece for me is that I saw those angels. I know they were. I was for a reason. Therefore, everything in the Bible is true. I don't need to read it to know it's true. In that sense, you know, I'm not one. Not that I was going to read it to disprove it, but I know everything in it is true, and the whole gemutz, the whole thing is true, etc. And more than that, things have happened in my life since. Since Natasha's died, that I would actually say are so unbelievable. If I was to tell that story, probably everyone here would fall over, because you cannot believe how things have been prophesied in one hand by people who vaguely know us, and then days later, literally, people who don't know us from another part of the world completely saying those words and have no relation. And you go, oh my gosh, it's so unbelievable how certain things happen.
So God has confirmed some things to you.
God's definitely confirmed, I'm here, basically. I'm watching you, I'm hearing you, and, you know, I'm with you. I think that's the big thing. I am with you always. And, you know, you just have to kind of reach out and touch, literally like the song, reach out and touch. And, you know, you can experience me, in effect. And that's what I've found, and Tanya as well, have found many times since. Mm-hmm. So palpable. Mm-hmm. But what's unusual about it, in a way, is if something, an experience of that magnitude, were to happen without having, you know, in another kind of world, you'd go out shouting about it like you'd gone berserk. But the funny thing about it is the biggest, and this is still kind of makes my mind, I kind of question it anyway, the biggest and most incredible thing in the entire world is actually your father, the God, if you like, actually to have a palpable interaction with him, even though you can't see, you know, like you can't just go, oh, here you go, and shake hands, and, you know, like in a sort of physical world. So things like that happen, and we've had it a few times in the way that things have happened with us. And you don't go, doesn't send you off the wall. It actually is so calm and natural. You assume it as though that's the way it is. So that's an interesting thing. From if an outsider was to look in, you wouldn't be kind of screaming, oh yeah, you know, like oh, I've won the lottery, for example, in this physical world. You just assume it because you know it's all true, it's right. It's almost like God prepares you for that you don't go off the wall afterwards. You know what I mean? I don't know how to put it in words, but it's so incredible when we've had meetings with government and, you know, the basic secretaries of state. Different ones, and very, very powerful business people. I mean, so powerful that, you know, I would never meet such people ordinarily in my life. And we always talk about God in some way at these meetings. But, you know, I say not overtly, but we do sort of kind of have this very strong faith, and that God wants us, or is pushing us, if you like, or, you know, if we call it pushing us, helping us to do the right thing, to help save other people's lives. And because God is always right, you know, absolutely, God is always right, and he is the truth and the light and all those things, it's to not mention it actually seems terrible in a way. Mm. So, and the fact that we might be talking to someone, the head of the biggest supermarket chain, the Prime Minister, if you like, or whoever, and not mention God seems unbelievable or unthinkable, because actually God, and we have the proof, I would say, in our hearts, how we feel, that God is the thing that governs us all, you know, in a way. And there we are running around trying to do, as people, things in our own strength, like I was in my, if I call it my former life, if I can only reference myself, because I know what that feels like. And as are many politicians running around, and, you know, et cetera, and business people. And hang on a minute, just, you know, what would God want us to do here? You know, do the right thing. That's what it is. And what is the right thing? Well, the right thing is to have great compassion and humanity for all those, you know, that are around you, whether you know them or not, or whether they've, I mean, literally, whether they have trespassed against you, you know, literally that. And to give, you know, not to hold those grudges and stuff, as I think people do, and I have done, when running around the world in your own strength. Mm. You know, you sort of build yourself into a profile, or a particular kind of sword is sculpted in your hand by your all the bad things you hold, if that makes sense. Mm. But here, you don't have to walk around with a sword. You know, if it's for, and this is the way I feel about it, if it's for the right thing, if it's God's plan, therefore, God who lays out the carpet, that rolls it out for you, and you just have to walk it, basically. You know, and the doors on each side of that corridor will open where they need to open. And we've felt this in the last few years so palpably, myself and Tanya, at meetings, to the point where if you were to actually say, what's the probability of that, you know, in the physical world, when you're thinking of it, looking, you go, no chance, mate, no chance. But actually, people are astonished by what's happening to us.
And when you say happening, are you talking on the spiritual level, or are you talking about the doors that are opening in terms of conversations with people at sort of very high levels of government and things like that, in terms of the changes you're trying to?
Yes, the changes. So you know, I suppose myself, Tanya, was pray before these meetings, you know, generally anyway, these particular meetings, and just ask God to walk into the room, knowing that he will, but we just ask God, please walk in the room before us, and you know, and give it, tell us what you want us to say, you know, give us the words, and we will just be your mouthpiece, you know, in that way, I mean, in the humble way. We're not going to try and ram our point across, and then, you know, that era for me is gone. You know, that was my former life. I'd call it my former life, where business meetings were about, you know, getting one over the other, you know, that you know, that thing, it's a deal making. Here there is no deal to be made with God at all, ever. It is just, there is one way, and I'd call it the way, the right way, if you to call it, I mean, the right way.
That's
the
what
good
the
way.
Christians called it the way.
Is it the way? And yeah. And that is how it must flow. And you know, if it's going to happen, and we feel that if God gives us the words, then more often than not things will go that way. You know, because that's what God wants, really. I mean, God, it's important to say, God, I really feel it. I had a period afterwards when I really did rage against God. I had that kind of moment, my human, I'm going to call it my completely human sort of selfish, if you like, moment, if that's the right way, where I raged against God. I told him, I swore at him in every way possible. I went off the wall. How could you do this to take my child, etc.? You know, all the things that you might imagine you do to someone, to a murderer. I'll be honest, a murderer had come into your house and killed your child and disappeared. So I didn't even catch the murderer. You know, I didn't have them in my hand, you know. And I raged, absolutely raged, you know, to the point of losing it, if you like. It's kind of almost like a delay. You know, I wasn't just the calm thing. It wasn't just like, oh, that's okay, my daughter died. That's not like that, really. I had this moment afterwards that came. And you know, but I got through that. You know, actually, it's the church, I have to say. There's only one thing that was going to get me through that, and it did, was every week going, you know, being part of the church community and having what you really see is all these people that don't know you. And not, I might add, like I felt that such in a typical Anglican, you know, setup, or Catholic, because my mum grew up as a Catholic. Not that she's a follower at all, by the way. But certainly in the old church I've been to in France, very austere, you know, that whole very structured, more us and them, you know, and the, you know, type of feel. But here in this sort of like more evangelical church, where I look around, everyone looks like me. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what age or colour they are. You know, really, just we're all the same. And their support and their kind of holding me, in effect, was, you know, I say transformational in a way. It really held me together and saw me through what I can just call the darkest part of my life. But then, you know, then the kind of really God, I'd say, really picked me up, you know, and has kind of made me much more what I am today, because I am definitely different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I used to swear a lot. I mean, really, all not like a on the street nonstop, but through frustration, through anger, or all those sorts of things, you know, I think fear probably, all those things bring out, I think, often the worst in people anyway, generally, in, I call it this physical world, the way, you know, the non-spiritual world, there you go, that's all better. And you know, like a builder, what you might call, yeah, it was awful, but it was quite normal for me, and I didn't even know I was doing it. And that, you know, since Natasha's died, you know, I really don't swear at all. In fact, I might have let slip the odd time once or twice, but it's 99.99999% gone, you know, in naturally so, yeah. I might add. Yeah.
Wow, what an amazing story. Absolutely incredible. Is there anything else that you would want to add before we go? Anything else about the work that you've been doing?
The Natasha Allergy Research Foundation is a charity started 7 months ago. And the point of that is to ultimately to save people's lives, mainly children and teenagers that have severe food allergies. And there's 2 million of them in the UK. Mm. Now, that's a huge number. And very little has been done for them, you know, really. And Natasha's sort of situation, her story, which blew up in the media, has brought that whole situation to light. And so myself and Tanya, with our very strong Christian ethos now, have said, right, well, we're going to do something about it. And God, will you help us? And he really is helping, I have to say. I mean, it's really tangible. And we're going to want to save as many lives as possible of children and families who will never even meet, you know, by getting laws changed, like Natasha's law, which is coming into force. Or by having, we're funding scientific research at the moment in Southampton University. Question, why are we becoming allergic? What is it? What are these triggers? And other things, you know, generally. And so we're working with government, we're working with some big, very big businesses to help fund the charity, mainly because scientific research is so expensive. You know, everything costs £1 million and upwards. You know, and so on. And we're acting on lots of points with a view to just have a real heart for what it is for families who kind of have been suffering in silence because nobody's understood them. Mm. And people have always dissed them as being fussy parents or annoying children that are really fussy eaters, you know, that sort of approach. Mm. And that's really, I would call that a classic lack of compassion for other people. And just because somebody's not dying doesn't, or the point of dying doesn't mean their problems aren't actually really important to them. Mm. You know, something in my Christian sort of view is a life group that we have every week at our house for a number of years now. When we go around the table, the room, so in the sofas, what would you like us to pray for? You know, someone will say, oh, my child at school, da da da. Someone will say, oh, well, I still have this leak in my roof and the builder hasn't fixed his tile. And then someone might say, well, my brother just been diagnosed with cancer. He has 3 weeks to live. And that's all in a matter of minutes as we go around the sofas. And actually, I think then where I would have been before, I would have said to those that, other than the one who said they were dying, I said, shut up, you guys, that's all irrelevant. You know, really get over yourself. That's how I would have been, actually. And now I go, gosh, that's not great, the roof, you know, et cetera. And I really listen because that's so important to them. I know that person hasn't just made that up, put their hand up just to be able to say something to fill the space. Otherwise, they'll feel unimportant. I know they've said that in the context of how we are in that room at the time, in life group, because it really is important to them. And it's something as important, you know, as someone else's, what you might call ordinarily much bigger problem. So that's a real change for me. I mean, before it was prioritize, forget it. You know, if it's below the 9 threshold, I'm not even listening. You know, stuff like that. But now I view the world really differently and listen to people. Whether I speak to people, homeless people at one end, or talking to Prince Charles, you know, at the other end, of, as it were, all the issues are there, and I take them in a very Christian way by listening and praying for them, actually, really. It's really interesting. It's fundamental change, going from the left side of the street to the right side of the street, if that's a way of looking at it. I call it, actually, it's not, that's a very bad way. I'd say it's really walking in the light. That's it. That is it, being in the light and not being in the dark. And that probably is the one sentence that sums the change.
That's all we've got time for today on The Profile, but join us next week where we'll hear from more fascinating Christian guests.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.